WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli of Broadcasting and Cable Magazine and TVWorthWatching.com, in for Terry Gross. Today's first guest, singer-songwriter Nick Cave, just started a new North American tour. Nick Cave is famous for his dark songs and for his rough voice, which brings out all the dark colors in those songs. In an article about him in Entertainment Weekly, Chris Nashawaty wrote, quote, "Over the years, Cave's songwriting has become more intricate and challenging, almost literary in its ambitions. He's one of the few artists in rock and roll who's managed to get better with age," unquote. Cave grew up in Australia and now lives in England. He wrote the screenplay for the bloody Western, The Proposition, and co-wrote the score for that film and for another Western, the 2007 movie, The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford. Terry spoke with Nick Cave earlier this year when Dig Lazarus Dig was released. Here's the title track.
Nest up in the autumn branches, built from nothing but high hopes and thin air. He collected up some baby blasted mothers, they took their chances, and for a while they lived quite happily up there. He came from New York City, man, but he couldn't take the pace, and thought it was like a dog-eat-dog world. And he went to San Francisco, spent a year in outer space with a sweet little San Franciscan girl. I can hear my mother wailing and a whole lot of scraping of chairs. I don't know what it is, but there's definitely something going on upstairs.
Nick Cave, welcome to Fresh Air. Tell me the story behind writing that song. What made you think about writing a song that refers to Lazarus?
I think I was getting some kind of revenge on my religious upbringing. I was particularly, as a child, it worried me a lot, that particular story, that Christ's greatest miracle was actually bringing someone back from the dead. And that kind of, as a child, creeped me out somewhat, to be honest. It didn't exactly traumatize me, but it felt kind of nice to sort of redress that in some kind of way and write a song about it. So I basically took the biblical Lazarus and dropped him in New York City and kind of a half comical look at what would happen to him in the contemporary world.
You said that you see the song as revenge for your religious upbringing. So many of your songs refer, you know, have biblical references or references to Jesus or God, and some in a more straightforward way, some in a more elliptical way, some in a comic way, some in a cynical way, some in a searching or loving way. Was that always true of your songs, or is this something more recent?
I think it was always true. I can remember as very young writing poetry, and the stories from the Bible always played a you know, there was always a strong element of that, even in my very, very early poetry, which I'm not going to
recite for us
recite
now.
For on radio. But there was a kind of fascination. There was a fascination when I was, you know, I was a choir boy at school, and at the cathedral that I went to, and I had to go to church maybe three times a week for about 3 or 4 years, and I was actually kind of interested. Especially in the biblical stories.
How old were you when you started reading the Bible?
I kind of got into the Bible because I went to art school and became very interested in religious painting. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that was because I understood the stories. I knew what those paintings were about, and I took a great interest in them. And then I think after that I started to kind of read, particularly the Old Testament, a lot. And I did that for quite a few years, And that had a huge influence over the way I saw the world, really, and also the songs that I wrote at that time. You know, and then I kind of gave that up and looked at the New Testament after a while.
But what's the difference between your Old Testament and your New Testament songs?
Well, I think that there's a kind of more humanistic approach to the characters in my songs, a more forgiving approach to the narratives.
Well, I want to play another track from your new CD, Dig Lazarus Dig, and this one also has a Jesus reference to it. It's called Jesus of the Moon. It's a beautiful song. I mean, it's a love song. Would you talk a little bit about writing this song?
Well, you know, I mean, I think that this particular record, Dig Lazarus Dig, despite the title, is probably the least obsessed or religiously obsessed record I made in years. It's really not about that. And there is a song called Jesus of the Moon, really, but I just felt it was a kind of nifty way of describing a sleeping woman. But it's I guess the reason why it's on the record, this particular song, is that it felt like, to me, a kind of fresh take for me on the leaving a woman type of song that I often write. There seemed to be a kind of rebirth in the whole thing that sounded kind of nice to me.
Oh, I think it's a great song. Let's hear it. This is Jesus of the Moon from Nick Cave's new CD, which is called Dig Lazarus Dig.
I stepped out of the St. James Hotel. I left you behind, curled up like a child. Change is gonna come. The door whispered shut. I walked on down the high windowed hall. You lay sleeping on the unmade bed. The weatherman on the television in the St. James Hotel said that the rains are gonna come. And I stepped out on the streets, all sparkling clean with the early morning dew. Maybe it was you and maybe it was me. You came on like a punch in the heart. You lying there with the light on your hair like a Jesus of the moon, a Jesus of the planets and the stars.
That's Nick Cave's song, Jesus of the Moon, from his new CD, Dig Lazarus Dig. You said that this was your least biblically obsessed record, in spite of the fact that we've heard two Bible or Jesus-related songs. But there's also a song on here called We Call Upon the Author to Explain. That's kind of like, you know, asking God to explain why life and the earth are such a mess.
Yeah, well, it is. You're kind of choosing three songs, really, that deal with that sort of thing. But the rest of the stuff doesn't. Although I'm sure you're going to pull out another song and say, "Oh, hang on about that song." But it actually felt to me while I was writing it that I was onto something different. Really felt, and it took me a lot of time to get there. Usually, I can spend a few weeks in the office where I write. Kind of anguishing over things, and I kind of get this out of my system and find something new to write about. This took a long time. This record took a long time to write and to find something new to talk about and a new way of using words, which I'm always kind of searching for. So I felt that it was very much a departure. But I guess at the same time, I have certain themes that I always come back to, and I guess I try and look at them from different, you know, vantage points.
You live in England now, but you grew up in Australia. Would you describe the town you grew up in?
It's called Wangaratta. I mean, it's about 18,000 people, and it was, but with very much a kind of small town mentality. And to be honest, I was quite happy to get out of there.
Because?
Well, it was very restrictive, and all the stuff that I find difficult with Australia is amplified a thousandfold in these small towns. And that's if you kind of stick your head too high above the parapet, it gets lopped off, if you understand what I mean. Everyone has to be kind of the same, you know, and hunker down. And I wasn't kind of interested in that. So it was quite difficult for me. It was quite difficult for my family in general, actually.
It was hard for me to imagine you fitting into a place like that.
Well, I didn't, and I got sent to Melbourne when I was about 12. It just wasn't working out in this town for me.
I got sent to a boarding school
in Melbourne.
Did you have access, either in Wangaratta or in Melbourne, to the movies and music and books that eventually meant a lot to you?
Well, I did. You know, I mean, when I was 9 or 10, we got the Johnny Cash show, for example, in Australia. That was shown in Australia on a weekly basis. So I watched that, and that had a huge impact on me. My brother, who was 4 years older, was very into music and listened to a lot of kind of great music. And so I was very much influenced by what he listened to. A lot of English progressive music, you know. So, you know, I was around music a lot.
What impact did Johnny Cash have on you?
Well, I remember distinctly watching the Johnny Cash show and my ideas about what music could be changing. You know, the gears kind of shifted, and something happened with the whole chemistry. My whole chemistry kind of changed watching that. There was something that I didn't really understand then, I guess, but that was so kind of edgy about that particular show.
And Johnny Cash himself, you know, in addition to his just incredibly moving voice, he was able to sing both about the spiritual and do really convincing murder ballads and revenge ballads.
Yeah, I mean, the way I looked at him when I was young was that he was an outlaw. You know, I'm talking about a young boy who was 9 or 10 watching this kind of stuff. But he seemed like that. It seemed like that rock and roll or music could be an outlaw kind of thing that operated on the periphery of society in some way. I've now since watched those shows on DVD, actually, recently, the Johnny Cash shows, and they're extraordinary.
Did Johnny Cash in a way help point the direction for you to music that both had a really dark and a really spiritual component?
I think absolutely. You know, I mean, the records that I had before that were the Herb Albert Tijuana Brass records, and I bought one of them, and then I went out and bought another one. So they were the first two records I ever bought.
That's really
and
funny. Then, and that then that's I kind what, of yeah, uh-huh.
You know, but I didn't know. You know, I was in a country town, there was something about that kind of music that I liked. But Johnny Cash kind of changed all that.
Nick Cave speaking to Terry Gross earlier this year. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview, recorded earlier this year, with singer-songwriter Nick Cave.
We were talking before about how, you know, you grew up in Australia in a small rural town, ended up having real problems, where you were sent to a boarding school. You had been in the choir, in the church choir, and then ended up, of course, in a band. When you started performing, did you create a stage persona for yourself? Did you kind of refashion yourself to be Nick Cave, the performer?
No, I don't think I did that consciously. But the thing about performing for me, I feel very much that I can be that person I always wanted to be. And there's something that's still very much about that to me. When I go on stage and I'm involved in the music and I hear the band playing and lose myself in the songs, I do lose myself and go to some other place, and it's and I feel that I become someone different. I don't think that it's a persona so much as I'm kind of lifted up to be the kind of person that I'd always wanted to be.
And who is that person compared to the person you think?
Well, it's kind of godlike, you know. It's not that ordinary person, and you go off stage and then suddenly you're that ordinary person again, you know. I mean, I remember that from far back as I can remember, really, but especially as a young boy, you know, I would listen to music and I'd pretend I was singing it, and I would imagine being on stage and singing this stuff to the crowds and all of that kind of thing, you know, and I would go into this other world, this alternate world, but I'm the way of kind of rock person should be, which is kind of half cartoon character, you know. It's kind of necessary. We should be seen from afar, you know, and be able to be drawn in broad strokes. And I think I've kind of managed that.
Now, we talked a little earlier about growing up in Australia, and one of the things about Australia is that, you know, the white people there basically came to start a penal colony. And you wrote the screenplay for the film The Proposition, which relates to that. And you wrote the score. You co-wrote the score for it, too. So we're going to hear the title clip, so to speak, the title scene in which the police captain actually makes the proposition. But set the scene for us. This is very early on in the film. Just summarize for us what's brought us to this point.
Well, the film opens with the kind of obliteration of the Burns gang by the police in a horrible kind of gunfight. And the two brothers, there's three brothers, but two of them have been captured. Mikey, which is the little one, and Charlie, which is the main character of the film. And the police chief presents these two brothers with a proposition in regard to Arthur Burns, a kind of renegade brother who has departed from the gang some time before and is living up in the hills. And what you will hear now is the proposition.
I wish to present you with a proposition. I know where Arthur Burns is. It is a godforsaken place. The blacks won't go there, not the trackers, not even my own men. I suppose, in time, the bounty hunters will get him. But I have other plans. I aim to bring him down. I aim to show that he is a man like any other. I aim to hurt him.
When you're ready, sir.
And what will most hurt him? Well, I thought long and hard about that. And I have realized, Mr. Burns, that I must become a little more inventive in my methods. Now, don't speak, Mr. Burns. Listen to me now. Don't say a word. I suppose I told you there was a way to save your little brother, Mikey, from the noose. Suppose I gave you a horse. A gun. Suppose, Mr. Burns, I were to give both you and your young brother Mikey here a pardon.
Suppose I said that I could give you the chance to expunge the guilt beneath which you so clearly labor. Suppose I gave you till Christmas. I suppose you tell me what it is I want from you.
You want me to kill me, brother?
I want you to kill your brother.
Arthur Burns is a monster. An abomination. You were right to part company with him.
That's Ray Winstone in a scene from The Proposition, which was written by my guest Nick Cave, who also co-wrote the score. That must be pretty exciting to write the screenplay and the music for a movie. It's a very brutal film and again relates to the origins of Australia as a penal colony. Since you are interested in like murder ballads and revenge and songs about those themes, are you particularly interested in the penal colony origins of your country of origin?
I mean, we all are. All Australians are, to a degree. I mean, for a long time we were, as a country, it was considered a kind of shameful aspect to our heritage. you know the fact that we come from colonial stock, and that we were prisoners initially, and criminals. But I think that that's kind of largely changed, and we're more kind of accepting of that these days.
Do you feel like when you were younger, you were into a kind of intentionally, like, transgressive image, and that as you've gotten older, that's just kind of changed, and the way you live life has changed?
Yeah, the way I live life has changed. I don't think I particularly had any kind of image. I was just the way that I was and interested in the things that I was at that particular time. I don't feel that there's much of a logic to the kind of trajectory of my life. It's just gone the way it has. At the moment, it feels strong. It feels strong, and that's a really nice feeling to have, especially creatively.
Nick Cave speaking to Terry Gross earlier this year. He's currently on a North American tour with stops soon in New York, Washington, D.C., and Philadelphia.